I'm Adam Miglio, Associate Professor of Old Testament and Archaeology at Wheaton College.
Dr. Adam Miglio, welcome to the Stone Chapel podcast.
Thanks. I'm really glad to be here. Glad to be back. Glad to be with you.
Yeah, it's good to see you. Great to see you again, and I hope all is well there up in Wheaton College. We do another podcast with you guys called Exegetically Speaking. We're going to tell people about that, put that in the show notes. But you're back with us to talk today about the Gilgamesh Epic. You've written a book that's going to be published early in 2023 entitled The Gilgamesh Epic in Genesis 1 through 11, and it's published by Routledge Press. So we're going to talk about that in a minute, but first of all, who is Adam Miglio?
I'm a happily married man to my wife, my bride, Sarah, and proud father of two sons, Everett and Graham. And as we jump into things like the Gilgamesh Epic, I have no better way to describe it than it's just been a wonderful epic journey with them through life over the last several decades.
So how old are your kids now?
I have a 15-year-old and a 12-year-old. They're a blast. We love it. We love to hike and kayak and really just enjoy the outdoors whenever we can here in Chicago.
Yeah. Well, you can't do it all year round exactly, but man, when summer comes and late spring, I mean, the weather's beautiful and we really, really miss that. It was beautiful times of year. All right. So let's talk a little bit about the Gilgamesh Epic. I guess there are people that probably have never heard of it. Some people have heard of it. Let's just get it on the table here and just talk a little bit about what is the Gilgamesh Epic.
Sure. The Gilgamesh Epic is what was probably the most widely read and best known literary text from ancient Mesopotamia, that's ancient Iraq. It was spread from Iraq to Syria, Iran, really to Israel. And it's just a riveting story about a king from the city of Uruk and his adventures, his epic adventures.
So what language was the Gilgamesh Epic originally? I mean, I know it's been translated in a variety of ways, but originally, what was the language of Gilgamesh Epic?
Yeah, it's written in several languages, the largest and longest compositions in Akkadian, but we have other shorter stories in Sumerian. It's translated into Hittite, and it lives on in lots of different traditions, all the way down to the Dead Sea Scrolls, where we have references to characters from the Gilgamesh Epic. So it's a testimony, I think, to how well-loved it was in the ancient world.
Yeah. Would it rival something like Homer's Iliad and Odyssey? I mean, in that part of the world, would it be sort of a counterpart to that?
I think it's a great example. There's a lot of similarities, not just in terms of the fact that they're beloved stories, but they're stories that are about journeys, epic journeys. And really, that's a driving metaphor in the Gilgamesh Epic. Life is a journey, and all that we can learn from that reflection.
So when you talk about these characters, were these real people, do you think, or were they sort of fictional characters? Or was it based upon real people? How do we look at that?
Yeah, it's definitely the last of those. That is, Gilgamesh, I think we can safely say, is a historical figure. But as the epic claims that he's two-thirds God and one-third divine, we may not want to necessarily affirm as some sort of historical claim. I think it's a story that's embellished to make a point.
Mm. And this epic journey, where does he go? He goes from Uruk where? Where does he go?
Yeah, he really does. He takes a couple of journeys. The first journey he goes on is from Uruk. And that only happens after he meets someone who becomes his best friend, a man named Enkidu. And in the first half of the journey, Gilgamesh and his friend Enkidu travel to a sacred cedar forest, which is called the abode, the dwelling of the gods. And there they meet this monstrous creature whose name is Humbaba. They kill him, they despoil and desecrate the forest, and then they return back home. And the second half of the story then, Gilgamesh goes on another journey, but one that's precipitated by the death of his dear friend Enkidu. Mm. And on his second journey, he's confronting the questions of human mortality and what he's lost.
Mm. So it seems to me very likely, as I've read this a number of times, and particularly in the past, that these are real people. These are people who are struggling with, like you say, mortality, life, the gods, all of these kind of things that we see reflected in the Hebrew Bible, reflected in other literature from the time, great literature of the time. I think of the book of Job, and I think of how he's struggling against the losses that he had, and how he's struggling with God and with himself and with his friends at that point. But Job sort of stays put, doesn't he? He's not really a traveler. He's not working these things out on a journey like we see with Gilgamesh.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think that that's one of the things about the story that is so engaging is all of its action. That is, there's these profound questions about what the human experience can teach us about our nature, how we as humans can use our abilities or exercise authority that we're given, and how do we make sense of things like suffering and loss in the world? And in a word, I think the Gilgamesh epic is all about wisdom and acquiring wisdom. So in that sense, again, it's akin to Job, but it's a story that's told with demigods and wily serpents and monumental constructions and monsters that I think grip people and invite them into not just the storyline then, but secondarily, these larger, I think, humanistic questions.
Mm. So this story is an enduring story. I mean, it's around, like you said, for a long, long time. And we see it, in a sense, refracted through other texts. You mentioned the Dead Sea Scroll, but we also have in Genesis 1 to 11, and that's part of your book. Your book is about the Gilgamesh epic in Genesis 1 to 11. There seems to be a connection between the two, right?
I would like to suggest so, or at least, and I've tried to write the book in a way that even if one doesn't want to argue, there's a genetic connection, that is, the writer of Genesis knows the Gilgamesh epic, that there's a benefit in reading the two together because they're both asking similar questions, as I've suggested, what's the nature of humanity, et cetera. And, you know, one of those similar questions, it's an enduring question, as you said, is the nature of humanity's potential. And it's striking when you read these stories, as I've mentioned, Gilgamesh is 2/3 God, 1/3 divine. The story tells us he's 18 feet tall, and with each stride, he strides 10 feet. He's this oversized, extraordinary human who's a caricature so that we can see clearly all of the potential and pitfalls of what it means to be human. And when we come to, say, for example, the book of Genesis, I don't think it's coincidental that Genesis invokes similar imagery to describe both the potential and later the pitfalls of humanity when it describes man and woman as made in the image and likeness of God, right? It's the appearance that's projecting this God-likeness of humanity, incredible potential. And then later on, of course, that potential can be harnessed for altogether untoward purposes.
Yeah. Well, I think of the giants, you know, when we talk about in Genesis 6, I mean, there's this notion of the giants that are there, the Nephilim, I think is the term in Hebrew. And people struggle with, you know, how do you translate that exactly? But from your description, it sounds like, you know, Gilgamesh is this giant of a man, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, those verses you're referring to in chapter 6, there, verses 1-4, are a precursor to the flood story. And I think that Nephilim is sort of gesturing toward the story of Gilgamesh, who is, by biblical definitions, like the Nephilim. And in the Gilgamesh epic, when Gilgamesh goes on this quest, the second quest, considering his own mortality, he's seeking out the one person who survived the flood, who is granted immortality in Mesopotamia. And so I think the Genesis account of things suggests that these Nephilim, who in that story are shut down, their mortality is indicated at the very beginning of the flood story, is presenting a very different perspective on human mortality than we end up with in the Gilgamesh epic, where the question of human mortality is left immortality is left open more so in the end at the flood story.
I guess that quest for immortality is just a constant in human experience, isn't it?
I think that's exactly right. And both the Gilgamesh epic and Genesis have responses to that, namely that humans are mortal and they therefore have to find meaning in the limits of lifetime. And they have slightly different answers, I think, to how you go about that. And they share some similarities in how you go about that.
Yeah. We're talking to Dr. Adam Miglio of Wheaton College about his book, an upcoming book called The Gilgamesh Epic in Genesis 1 to 11, published by Routledge Press. Now, that's going to be out soon, but it's already being used in classrooms. I mean, you've sent out some precursors yourself of these, and it's already being used.
Yeah, I'm using it in my classes already, of course, and I've had other generous colleagues who've been willing to test it as well. And so I'm excited that others are reading it and using it.
Yeah. The flood story in Gilgamesh Epic is a phenomenal story. It's key to, that's like you said, the second part and such, which just lends credence to me to the idea that something like that happened, right? That there was an event like that where it just seemed as if the entire world is just covered with water.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's several flood stories from Mesopotamia in addition to the one that we have in Genesis 6 through 9. There seems to have been some sort of cataclysmic event that humanity is responding to and picks up as a really important event for theological reasons, both in the Gilgamesh Epic and in Genesis. And the question in both stories, as they recount it, the theological question that is what kind of a God sends a flood like this, or gods send a flood like this? Mm-hmm. And in the Gilgamesh Epic, you end up with one answer, namely, the gods are easily carried away by caprice. Sometimes they get worked up and they do this. They make mistakes. And in the Genesis account, you end up with a very different story. I think it's tempered. That is, the Genesis account wants to say, well, no one can really understand why God does what he does, but it insists that he's both just and merciful as we look at the event. And in that sense, I think it's offering a slightly different answer, even if there's an inscrutability to the biblical God.
Well, it's interesting to me that there's so many parallels to the stories in Genesis, to ancient Near East stories from other places, including Mesopotamia, but Egypt comes to mind as one as well. But it's dealing with some really basic human, where did all this come from? How did it all get started? I think of the Marduk, the story with Marduk and Tiamat and all that about creation and how all that came about and how humanity plays into that. So many of those characteristics that we find in Genesis seems to be a response to other stories out there, seems to be a corrective to me to what's being said in some of these other stories about where this world all came from.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the analogy I would draw for those who might be more familiar with the New Testament is Paul at Mars Hill in the book of Acts. He certainly read and he knows his Greek philosophy, right? He's quoting Epicureans and Stoics and quite comfortably. And he's doing two things, right? He's finding common ground and he's offering corrections or counterpoints, one might say, to these philosophies. I think Genesis is doing the same thing with Gilgamesh.
It's interesting. I've never thought of it that way.
Yeah, I mean, the way that we think about what it means to be human, it's not that Genesis is the first occasion for thinking about that question. Mesopotamians had thought about it for a long time. It's not that Genesis is the first to think about how we should use authority. Gilgamesh is an incredibly cruel king at the beginning of the story. And he learns what it is to be a part of human society and to live in meaningful ways in life. And
well, Enkidu is his teacher, right? He's his teacher.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, Enkidu's in many ways a teacher, a pedagogue in this way, for sure. And it's wonderful. I tend to think the Old Testament in general, but Genesis 1 through 11 in particular, is a wonderful instance of engaging in a pluralistic religious context where we have to address, or we see addressed, big humanistic theological questions with awareness and understanding of other traditions. And I think it's precisely what Genesis is doing.
All right. So they're going to make your book into a movie, you think, Adam?
Well, they should make the Gilgamesh Epic into a movie. I'm just not sure what it would be rated.
Yeah. There's a few moments in there, right? It probably would not be PG or PG-13, no. I would think. But yeah, I've always wondered why it has not been made into a movie.
I wish it would be. I think it'd be a fabulous movie. It's just such a riveting story.
Yeah. And it would bring some things back to us from the ancient world that we might need to think about yet again.
Yeah, it has some. There's some wonderful plays and others, operas, etc., that have been done on it. But a movie would be great.
Well, let's talk to Mel Gibson about it. Maybe Mel Gibson would do it. Who knows? You never know.
Martin Scorsese, maybe.
Maybe Scorsese. Yeah, exactly. We're talking to Adam Miglio of Wheaton College about his book, The Gilgamesh Epic in Genesis 1-11, coming out in early 2023. Adam, thanks for being with us today on the Stone Chapel.
Always a pleasure.
If you learned too much today in the podcast, there is one guaranteed cure, and that is to share it with a friend. It'll take the pressure off the brain, okay? If you've never visited the amazing Lanier Theological Library, make plans to do it soon. We are growing. We're expanding. We've got a new presence over in Oxford, England. This is a place of solace and discovery. If you have comments for us or questions or just want to be in touch, contact us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. And thanks to all those who make this podcast possible. You know who you are. Till next week, thanks for listening.
As humans, I think that we don't always understand from our limited perspective the meaning of life. But the Gilgamesh Epic, I think, offers a gem in insisting that we make sense of meaning in life through our everyday roles as husbands and fathers in the Gilgamesh Epic, or in places and positions of authority.